accession number 23433, reel 7.
Jeff Kirk, reel 7.
Now, I have a theory. Now, have a fair thing, Les Worthy. Now, he won the American Bronze Star at Brest. His tank got blown up and the turret was blown clear out. The other two members of the turret crew got killed, and he got both his legs smashed up. Now, he was so upset or nervous, or I don't know what it was, but that he wouldn't even let us have his telephone number. We've only ever seen him once. Well, we had only ever seen him once since the war, and that was when he came up to Harrogate one evening. Then I wrote an article, a Christmas message, you know, saying about how it affected him. I said that nobody can go through the flames of war and come out the same the other side. I said it affects everybody, both mentally and physically, and often it's the mental stress that takes more difficult to heal. But I said admitting that you've got it is most likely the thing that helps it heal. And he wrote and thanked me for this message, see? And so I said to him, he lives up in Ripon in Yorkshire, I said, well, why didn't you come to our mini reunion, King's Lynn, because I thought that's less distance from the trouble. The next thing I know, he turns up at a turn the page at Canterbury, that was in the April. So, and he said that, oh, I think I'll come out to Brest with you, see? So it's a welcome, you know, I arranged it all out then, right? And I said, you're welcome. He said, well, I won't be travelling with you. I'll be getting my son and daughter going to come. So his son came over with it. He had a Range Rover light. And Les and his wife, Margaret, and Anne and David all came over. Well, they didn't come with us, but they landed where they landed, where Les landed originally. And when he landed, he met a French boy whose father was a baker. So he spent all day trying to locate this boy. But he couldn't find him, he got on the mare and he got onto everybody. So he came on to Brest where we were. And then we had a phone call which we misunderstood. We thought he wasn't coming, but what it was, they found the boy, who now, I suppose, 50 or 60. Anyway, but we went round the battlefield with Les and, you know, we talked about everything. We showed him where it was and we go to the Marvellous Museum. They got one of their flame tanks there. They've built a trailer there. In fact, they've even got a model about 4 foot long of a tank, a flame tank, which fires water instead of flamethrower fuel, but it also fires grill shots, which is automatically loaded, and it's television controlled and television viewing of the turret. And because going around the battlefields with him, he starts talking about things. Now, when he left us, like he was left early because he was going to meet this boy he met when he landed. And his wife said she'd never met such a change in a person in all of his life as Les. And I feel that it's let the stress out of him because he didn't have to explain anything to us. We all knew what was going through his mind. We'd all been through it. So it's not talking to counsellors. I mean, I wrote in one of my Christmas messages, as soon as something happens, oh, we're counsel, we give you counselling, we get counsellors, we're sending the counsellor. What counselling did we get? None. But we got the best counselling of the lot, and that is their own comrades, who you don't have to explain, eh? I said, plus the fact, the crew were family. You lived together, you slept together, you knew more about that man than his wife will ever know, because you spent 24 hours a day with him. You knew what he liked, the way he picked his nose or combed his hair or shaved or anything, whatever he did. And you learned to know all his preferences, his dislikes, the things he hated doing. And all the crews, you know, lived differently, because there were five men thrown together by absolute random, I suppose, because each one had a trade and that was it. And they all had to live together, and your crew became your family. And this is what gave a tank crew its strength, with its family, the bonding that was built up amongst you, because there's nobody to say, oh, you're dodging the column, because you were all in the same column together. If a tank got hit, you didn't know who it was going to hit. When you came out the line, you all had your jobs to do. Well, each tank crew settled down to its own way of doing it. Some tank crews, one did all the cooking, some took it, each member of the crew took in it. We used to, you know, do whatever was doing. The only person that didn't do the cooking was Captain Barber. But he was such a nice bloke, he went off to an O group. There was always a meal ready for him when he came back in the O group. You know, this was, to us, was our part for him, what he was doing for us, like. And, all our crew loved him. Well, everybody. I've never heard a bad word said against Barber. H.D. Barber. They used to call him Derek. I don't know whether he did. Perhaps his name was Henry. H.D.C. Barber. And Derek, they always called him. So whether he didn't like his first name, or I don't know. Because the officers were always called by their Christian names amongst themselves. Like, you know, not like us, you know. Everybody had a nickname, basically, you know. They used to call me Cowboy Kirk because I used to have a pistol slung low, like, you know. Even Paddy Scullin, the Sergeant Major, used to call me Cowboy Kirk. Now, I was his butt boy. Let's say this Paddy never did me any harm. He's the man I said about sent me over to the cookhouse for an hour, but okay, so what? But if he walked out the hut or walked anywhere, the first thing he'd shout at was, Kirk, get your hands out of the pocket. Now, I could be 10 miles away, but as soon as he said, Kirk, get your hands out of the pocket, every hand in, every came out of every pocket. And this is what he was like all the time. I mean, he'd walk along the line with a thing, and he'd get on to me because my boots were dirty. Now, everybody's boots are filthy, but as soon as you dismissed, everybody went back and cleaned their boots. So, you know, to me, whether Paddy had sized me up, was it not worrying me? Now, Paddy used to love cowboy books, say, and when we're pissed, he said, "Ah, Cowboy Kirk." I said, "Yeah, have you got the cowboy book, Sergeant Major?" See? And he said, "It's no good talking to you." Like, you know, well, I suppose I was thicked up or just, you know, lumbered it. It didn't really worry me. I mean, no, I'll say this with Paddy. The only time he did any harm to me was I joined C Squadron the day they left Ashford, right? Now, I was told to report there at 7 o'clock in the morning. I reported there, and the sergeant said, "Get your kit and get aboard that wagon." So, like a good soldier, I put my kit aboard and got aboard the wagon, and I put my head down. Next thing I know, somebody's got hold of my ankles, and I'm drawn straight out of the lorry, bang on the ground. And there's a sergeant made of Paddy Scullin there with Gracie, the quartermaster. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, the sergeant told me to get my kit aboard and get aboard the wagon." He said, "He didn't tell you to go to sleep, did he?" I said, "He didn't say go to sleep, stay awake." He said, "Oh, one of those come with me." So he said, "All those boxes there, now they're all the office equipment, all tin boxes, like travelling trunks." He said, "Load them up." I said, "On my own?" He said, "Well, you were asleep when you were." So I struggled and I built a flight of steps and rolled them up the steps like that, but of course I couldn't get the last one up. And Paddy is due, he did come along and he gave me a hand to get the last one on. But I'll say, he never did me any harm, Paddy's going.
And you didn't take it to heart?
No, he walked off with ducks back, I suppose, like, you know. But that's why he took me, I was his buff boy, like, you know, and he knew it didn't affect me, like, and but it kept discipline, I suppose, for him amongst everybody else. Like, he got on to me and everybody thought, "Oh, I've got to do so and so." But Paddy was all right. But that's a bit about, you know, did I give you a bit about where we went up to refuel the tanks?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, well, about D4, I think. Mm. Well, Paddy came over about D2 or 3. Well, he said to me, "Right, get the lorry, got to go and refuel the tanks," see? So he said, "We only got two tanks." He said, "Load it up." So we put the 40-gallon barrels on the side, gas bottles on the bottom, petrol, ammunition, food, water, right? And it's filled right to the brim. Now, Titch and I, and Sid Large was the driver, we went there, he gave me a map reference, and he said, "Right, go and refuel the map, we're going through the tank." So we went across the Route Bayou, went across the level crossing, right, and dug in the side. Well, now, first of all, there was all the ambulances lined up. Then there were some quads, and then there was the anti-tank guns dug in the ditches, see? And I thought, that's queer. And they're all shouting out to us, and we gave them the two-figure salute, right? But we went on, and then all of a sudden, this red cap jumped out of the slip trench with his chain gun and said, where are you going? So I said, I'm going to refuel the tanks. He said, you go around that corner, you'll get refueled. So anyway, I said to Titler, I was back in the drive here, like, you know, gateway there was there, but the mortars were coming down, and the old spando was going, burr, burr, and the brain was going pop, 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 and we sat there, and I said, Sid, it's time we were gone, and back we came. Well, I was on guard somewhere between 11 and 12. Paddy came up to me, and he said, you got to go refuel the tanks. I said, not me, Sergeant Major, I'm on guard. He said, you're relieved. I said, yeah, you relieve me now. I said, and I'll come in at 3 o'clock in the morning, told it's my turn to do a guard. He said, I'm coming up with you. I thought, well, it must be safe if Paddy's coming. Mm-hmm. But he didn't tell me he was coming up there on the dingo. So away we went, and we got up there. Now, there's an abbey. If you look at the map of that thing, go across the level crossing in Bayou, don't take the main road that goes straight to Tilly, the minor road, and then go up there, turn left, left again, and on the right hand side is a little abbey. We've got a map for it if you want to see it. And anyway, we got there, Paddy jumps out and said to the driver, up the road, find the tanks. Well, he couldn't find them. And he came back and he said, stay here until I get back. I'll go to Brigade HQ and find out where they are. So I said, so what are we going to do? I said, well, get the brain gun, get a box of mags, we go over that clump of bushes, dig a slit, and line it up on the thing, and I said, if anybody interferes, it, and up we go, the lot. See, so anyway, we did that, and then Paddy came back just as it was getting daylight. He went up the road, he came early back, he said, get on the wagon, get the wagon started up, hurry up, get away. So I ran across and I got this box of mags. Well, I must have failed to clip it the lid on, and I threw it up in the tailboard of the lorry. They were scattered over the road, and I'm picking them all up, and Paddy said, you've got a time for that, get on the wagon. Well, we went up there, and we were loading past the ammunition through to the only person I remember in the crew was Chris Bright, and it could, he always mentioned it to me, when we used to go to reunions. And I remember you coming up with the ammo when we were out of ammo, he said, out there, passing it into us, right? And then we put the petrol in that, and then we went to the next tank, and back we came. In the morning, my mother always used to send me 200 Churchman's number ones, because I made an allowance of seven bob a week home to her, shilling a day it was. When we were in England, she used to send me my cigarettes out. They arrived on a Tuesday morning because we were desperate. But then she used to send me boxes of 200 because they got paid for it in the tobacconist duty free. But a RSM came up that morning with the mail, right, and 200 cigarettes. So I opened them up and I stuffed a packet in my thing, and as we were going in, I had them in my pocket. Well, when I was reaching, got off my seat to try and reach George Steele, they must have fallen out and were laying on the turret floor. Then I got him and put him down by the feet of our wireless operator, Jack Washington, and then I reached through for Chris Bright, and I just bagged him when Carol got killed there. And the next thing I know is there's these brand new packet of Churchmans floating about in the blood in the bottom of the turret. There's about, I don't know, an inch of blood I've loaded, and the tank was jogging about, so my brand new packet of Churchmans number one floating.
Do you think at that moment you knew what had happened?
I didn't really know what had happened. I knew we'd been hit, I knew that Carol had fallen on top of me, and what the extent of the damage was I'd want. And that's when I'd say, at the time, I remember him falling on top of me, and I couldn't get up, and I couldn't get Chris in the turret, that was when I started floating about in the heavens above, looking down in the turret, looking through actually the cupola, looking down in the cupola, seeing all the chaos in there. And I thought,
because you had shrapnel in your head.
I didn't know that at the time.
No,
right?
But you would.
The sheer blast knocks you unconscious temporarily. Yeah. Because I still feel that my brain is partly addled. I think, like, the pressure wave is so great that, you know, like you get sort of punch drunk. Because while I can remember, you know, things often clearly, but if I can't remember anything, I can't remember. It's gone. There's no... don't ask me why, I don't know. Plus the fact, if anybody asks me to do anything, I have to do it now. If I don't do it now, I shall forget or put it off. I'm the greatest procrastinator under the sun. That's why I wrote for you the other fine day, a letter's crossed in the post, didn't it? Because I thought, if I don't do it, I shall never do it.
Just one query. What does the term sunray mean? I've not heard
sunray. That. Sunray, that was the technical term that you use for a senior officer. It could be, you know, a colonel, a lieutenant, a general, or anything. Where's your senior sunray? It means your senior officer, right? Hey.
Would you like to just mention again about the dead horse?
Oh, the dead horse, right. Well, we were going to do an attack on Sir Duggan Bosch, right? We just put the new engine in at Winston, right? And, yeah, we were going in to do the attack. We were going on the road and we stopped. Now, there was some cottages on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side was a crashed Spitfire. And right alongside this crashed Spitfire was a grave, the airman, I suppose, the pilot, and there was all flowers, all in jam jars on it, you know? We then moved on a bit, and there was a horse that I presume had just been killed by, you know, gunfire, like. And all the Dutch people were out there with their knives carving meat of it, because they were all starving, see? And they were carving meat of it. And that is the last thing I remember until I was in the kitchen meeting those two boys, you know. The next, I don't know, 3 days, I suppose, were absolutely, because we went to Newland and anything what I didn't actually see was that was the first time they'd ever flamed across a canal to burn the housing on the other side to let the infantry get across the canal. That was at the Duggan Bosch. While in the 79th Armoured book, it said it was five and four five. It wasn't, in actual fact, it was a Duggan Bosch. It was the 141 C Squadron who flamed across the thing, set the thing, and that let the infantry get across the lock gates to get the other side of the canal, right? Which is, as far as we're concerned, was a novel use. Wasn't it? We hadn't seen many canals, and B, you know, it got them across there. Because if you read the history, the first time they flamed the wrong side of the bridge line, then they had to have another go. And there is a famous photograph of a Shell petrol station with the tank with the flame shooting out of it. Right, you know, and it said down there to credit in Jock Robb, Sergeant Robb, eh? But Ian Shell said it was his tank. Well, Ian's dead and Jock Robb's dead, so I don't want to denigrate either of them. Like, you know, to me, it wasn't my tank, so I don't have to worry. But, that is a complete blank of my mind. I cannot even think of anything I remember.
But can you remember any thoughts that you had? Can you remember any thoughts that you might have had at the time?
No.
Emotions?
No.
You were just
The last thing I saw, look out, I saw the Frenchman cutting up, or the Dutchman cutting up this horse. Yeah. And after that, there was a complete, absolute blank. But three days, I suppose, I don't know. And the next thing I can remember was playing the parts of being in the kitchen, pumping up the Primus, and the boys opening the door. Because when we went back there, and I told you, we went... I looked round and I couldn't recognise anywhere, and this little van turned up to deliver a table. The man in the house who married their sister invited me in, see? I said, come in, see? And he said, would you like a cup of coffee? I said, yes. So he walked, coffee, because it was like a big open area with a kitchen going down there, see? And I said to him, is that the toilet here? He said, yes. I said, do you want you? I said, no. I said, is that the back door? He said, yes. I said, I now know I'm in the right house. Well, when I went there with Franz, because Franz said to me, now, I'd like some photographs of you outside my original house, eh? Because he lives round the corner now. And he said, all right, we've got to be at sharp. I said, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, because we've got a service in St John's Cathedral at 10 o'clock, eh? Well, who turned up? Alec Thompson turned up, Jim Harling turned up, Steve Riches, Andrew Wilson and myself, I think it was, eh? We all turned up, and we went into the house, like, and, oh, that's right, television crew turned up. So I said, nothing to do with you, you know, this is private. Oh, and the bloke said, no, it's all right. He said, we don't want to interfere. He said, you do what you like, we just give us time to put the video together, eh? So then I was describing what actually happened, eh? But afterwards, Franz said to me, don't recognise this, do I? I said, no. I said, I know I'm in the right place because the toilet's there and the back door's there. Eh? And I'll tell you why I remember this, because we'd used the toilet because there's no water, was there? Now, the Dutch woman, when she came in, did a little lulu. What she said, I don't know, because I don't speak Dutch like, but she did like what we'd done in her pant like. And but he said, oh no, because I remember when we went in, there was a little front room, and there was the dining room, I suppose, and then there was the kitchen, see, down there. Well, of course, they cleared the lot out, turned it into one big open space with a thing, and he said, that's when Franz said to me, you don't recognise this, do you? I said, no.
So was he surprised?
Eh?
Was he surprised that you didn't recognise it?
I think he knew why I didn't, because he was the one who said to me, you don't recognise it, do you? I said, no, I know I'm in the right place, because there's the toilet and there's the back door,
yeah.
And this is where the table was, I had the primers on.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I know I was in the right house, right? Yeah.
What year did you go back?
That was 85. Yeah. That's when I met Franz and also met Cora. I've got the photograph of three boys throwing snowballs, the outside two boys at a Cora and Franz line. But the middle boy was a neighbour. Now, nobody knew where this was, because they couldn't find it, so I eventually found it. But the following day I'm going up there, like, knowing exactly where I'm going to, see, and there was a paper boy there. Now, when we went out there, on the back of every newspaper was Thank You Liberators, the complete page, eh? So I was talking to him, I said, oh, he just come over, and then I showed him this photograph. Oh, he said, I know where that is. He recognised that it was the block of flats, obviously he recognised. And yet nobody else did, like, but he knew straight away. He said, oh, I know where that is, that's Langenstrasse. Mm-hmm. Well, Lagerlandstrasse, isn't it? I said, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he said, I recognise that straight away. And that's it. Oh, no, I'm in the Dutch, I admire the Dutch night, and, I don't know whether they made a lovely speech the last time I went out there, the mayor of Stellenbosch, like,
yeah.
About, you know, how thankful they are for the liberators, like, because the first time we went in there, we went there and we marched into town and the crowds were six abreast all the way in there, like, you know, oh yeah, they treat you like royalty, and the children used to come up and, can I shake your hand, like, you know, and everywhere you went, you know, you know, the thing, you know, it's, yeah, I'd say they've always looked after us there, and when we go out there, we've got our host light.
That's genuine gratitude.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, well, now, that Dutch mayor, if I can find his speech, because Molly liked his speech, so I said, I'll put it in the milestone,
right.
See?
Right.
And he said that one gratitude is, it sort of phrased it, you know, we mustn't be sort of thing, we've got to be thankful, and that, I can't think of his phrasing of it, like, you know, and but he, you know, it's got the wording off dead right.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the milestones out there might have it in there.
Yes, we can look at that in
We got, there was a great big, we went in this thing there, like, and there's a great big vat, I mean, we just about got it in this room, like,
yeah.
Filled with Calvados, and we filled red jerry cans up with Calvados and everything, like.
This is at the time when you were recovering McFarlane's tank.
Yeah. Calvados. We used to run on Calvados after that, because we We went into workshops, I think, and their water bottles were filled with cow dust, right? And I always remember the fitter said, they've got any drinks? So I said, yeah, and you could see their hats take off, like. Right?
Yes.
Shall I say where we're at?
Say where, yes. Where it's from.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
We went out to Satungabos. Oh, I better put my...
Yeah, I'll speak on. In 1999, we went out to Satungabos, where we'd almost been given the freedom of the city and were always made welcome. And the mayor made... I went out there with my wife, and the mayor made a speech which impressed my wife. And the mayor of Satungabos said, as mayor of Satungabos, I have the privilege of speaking to you today. I do believe that no other feeling is so appropriate to the first setting foot in this city as silent gratitude. Even today, silence best expresses the deep respect Satungabos have for you and all the freedom fighters. Satungabos had tried to make a place for its gratitude each year to celebrate the return of our freedom. Boys, you who now rest in peace and whose grave we still visit, but Satungabos would rather have welcomed many more veterans today. Men together with you went to war, young men, friends of yours who can't be here today because they sacrificed their lives for our freedom. There's all the talk of we will provide counselling, but no counselling was provided for us who suffered or could have suffered the disaster every day. We had that one great advantage that enabled us to cope both mentally and physically. We suffered together. In a tank you had the companionship of your family, the rest of the crew. To the lonely, the sick and the worried, may you find comfort and friendship. Why not write a card to a member of your regiment on the regimental list? To a member that asks you to reply, it may mean so much to whom you reply. Add to their enjoyment to Christmas and make a new year and a new century the start of a new outlook of hope and strength.
Nice.
Yeah. That, you see, we may become fewer, therefore let us be more thankful that we live on. All those who are at the sharp end of the war are fully aware that we're living on borrowed time, and it must make us even more thankful that we were spared physically, if not mentally. While it is possible to adapt the world about us, it is the inner world of the mind which is not so easily mended, and it is the scars of the furnace of war that are more difficult to heal. The admitting that these scars are maybe the best, admitting that these scars are there may be the best way to, if not heal, attempt to affect and keep it within bounds. Let us say a prayer and give a thanks for all those who have lost loved ones, not necessarily but today, recently, but still grieve their loss and miss their love and companionship with which they shared all their lives. We who have been spared some of life's misfortune should be thankful and pleased, and thankful that we all, for all that we have. There is a lot of truth in the old adage, there are many who are worse off than we are.